Leadership shouldn't be about who speaks the loudest, but rather who speaks the truest. I'm Charlotte Otter. Welcome to Speech Bubbles, the podcast that's rewriting the rulebook on leadership, communication, and success. In every episode, we're bursting the bubbles of traditional leadership, bringing you raw, real conversations with trailblazers who don't just challenge the status quo, they obliterate it. We're talking to heads of communication who know the power of words, HR mavericks reshaping workplace culture, and leaders from backgrounds that have been silenced for far too long. This is where vulnerability meets strategy, where authenticity beats artifice, where diverse voices don't just speak, they roar. Whether you're climbing the corporate ladder or building your own, Speech Bubbles is your roadmap to leadership that's human, powerful, and unapologetically you. Are you ready to transform how you communicate, lead, and succeed? Then let's burst some bubbles. My guest today is Emily Monsell Holden. Emily Monsell Holden is a founder, TEDx speaker, mentor, podcast host, and regenerative business advocate. She's also an actor, wild swimmer, forager, gardener, fermenter, traveler, and storyteller. After 20 years leading marketing and communications, Emily co-founded the Impact Apothecary, a no-nonsense anti-consultancy that helps purpose-driven businesses with their branding, marketing, and business strategy. She believes business has a role to play in making the world a better place. In her podcast, Year on Year, she explores how long-term thinking in business can lead to positive changes that strengthen more than the balance sheet. Emily is a TEDx speaker and coach, and last year moved audiences to tears with her powerful speech on being a woman who has not had children. Emily says womanhood is so intrinsically tied up with motherhood that a woman without a child is fundamentally strange in a way that just isn't the case with men. She says, "We tell young women and girls that they can be whoever they want to be, but we are preventing that from becoming true because we are obsessed with women's reproductive status." Emily Monsell Holden, welcome to Speech Bubbles.
Oh, thank you. You've kind of made me feel a bit emotional there. Thank you. That was a really lovely intro.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Sometimes I feel emotional reading them, and I also feel a bit gulpy reading yours. I think that's okay to be slightly gulpy. So, Emily, your TEDx speech was so moving, and I can't actually watch it without crying. Firstly, because of your own emotion, that's raw, but also your message, which is positive, because of the power that's inherent in what you're saying, which is we need new language to describe women who don't have children. We need to break out of that binary. Could you say more about that and how we can stop holding women back?
Yeah, I guess what I really, when I wrote that talk, it was really hard because there are so many important and emotional messages that you can give on that topic. And it was a really good exercise for me, really, to think, actually, what is the thing that I want to get out there? And it really was the fact that I don't think that we have enough variety in the female role models that we hold up. Of course they exist, but it's just harder to find. And I appreciate there is a bias when you're in the middle of something. You see everyone who is the complete opposite or everyone who you feel has it all. And I know that that isn't really the case. But certainly when I was struggling to come to terms with the fact that I wasn't going to become a mother, I felt like all of the stories of feminine success were somehow linked to motherhood. And it might be, often the story was, oh, she's incredible. She's running a business. She's doing this, this, and this. And she's got two kids. How does she manage? And it was almost sort of as if that story about being a mother was always the foundation. And if there was a similar woman who had achieved all sorts of success and happiness and didn't have children, it was then, oh, but she hasn't got a family. And that subtle but really quite pervasive narrative of femininity and female success had such a big impact on me. And it definitely contributed to my identity struggles when I realised that I wasn't going to become a mother. And I suppose if that answers your question, the language we use is part of that. And more importantly than pure language, we just need to celebrate women in all of their guises who are living fulfilled lives.
Yeah, I love that. And what's coming up for me is we don't say, oh, he's a CEO and he runs a brilliant business and he has five children. So it's like around women, it's more than we need new language and more descriptors. We also need new stories. We need new ways of celebrating women.
And it's not to do down women who are juggling all of this stuff, because it is incredible. And I don't know how a lot of women do it. So it really isn't about pitting one woman's path against another. I really feel quite strongly about that, because I think that feeds into this division, which is not helpful. It's just about saying there is more than one way to be happy and fulfilled. And it's not saying that every woman who is happy or fulfilled needs to tell her story. And also, it doesn't need to pretend that she's not struggling sometimes, because, of course, life is sort of peaks and troughs. But I just think if I had more examples of women who weren't mothers, who were in some way happy and fulfilled and going and pursuing other interest activities, even if that was just doing a 9-to-5 and going home and being happy, then I think I would have found it a bit easier to see that there was a light at the end of the tunnel for me.
Yeah. Now, your speech, your TEDx talk was a year ago, and you've since been called upon to speak more on this topic. What are the kind of resonances and responses you're getting from audience and people who have listened to the speeches or are in the audience when you're talking?
It was really interesting, because I genuinely felt that this was mainly a message for women who didn't have children. And of course, that is, I've opened something there, and I still get messages from people I don't know online pouring their heart out, really, and telling me some very personal things, because it's very clear that there is not enough conversation, open conversation about the journey that women go on, and particularly for women who don't end up with children, whether that was through choice or circumstance or whatever it might be. So I get a lot of very powerful messages from that contingent. I also get a lot of messages from women who have children, because ultimately this is about the identities that we sort of transpose onto women. And it does kind of feel like you're either a mother or you are a weirdo. And women who have children, I can't talk, this is not my experience, but I have, most of my friends have children, are frustrated by the fact that they are primarily seen as a mother, and then the rest of the stuff comes afterwards. So it's kind of actually surprisingly a conversation that is for all women, because it's like, look, we may or may not have children, and that will have a larger extent on our impact on our lives or not. But that isn't the only thing that defines us. And all women have got interests and opinions and thoughts and experiences. And I suppose also digging into why we've got to this place, which becomes quite an interesting journey through patriarchy and repression of women and ownership of women through the ages. And ultimately wondering how much that has really changed for all of the celebrations we have around International Women's Day. The fact that we still need to have these conversations shows that there's still some quite deep lingering associations present. Yeah, and actually, I would just say that men also have approached me, because it's not my experience of being a man without children. And it's such a sensitive topic that I try to never speak on behalf of other people. I try to just tell my story and use that as a way for other people to, if they want to, open up and tell their stories and start conversations. So I don't talk about what it feels like to be a man without children, because I'm not one. But men without children have approached me and said that they feel hugely underrepresented. And I think they are, because I'm talking about being a woman and the specific challenges that come with the feminine identity. But there's a big conversation to be had with men and fatherhood and what that means as well.
Yeah. Absolutely. And it goes back to what you're saying, that we're obsessed with women's reproductive status. But when you talk about your story and it being very unique and specific to you, I do know that the more specific a story is, and the more human it is, and the more it is described with emotion, the more universal it is. And that's what you're saying, is that you're having a kind of universal response, or you're receiving a kind of universal response to your very, to your unique and very individual and very specific story.
Because it's such a sensitive subject and such a private subject, understandably, most people don't want to talk about it. And I don't necessarily relish talking about these deep personal things, but partly it has been a healing journey for me talking about these things. But I also just think that me telling my story just opens up some kind of energetic channel that allows other people to talk about their story, or at least just think, I'm not alone. And that was the main thing I wanted to do, because when I was in those darker days, I was looking around and I was like, I just need to know that I can be happy without having children. And I didn't feel that I could. So what I just really needed were some other women who'd been there and done that to be like, hey, you know, I was there too. It's pretty bad. I can identify, but do you know what? I'm fine. I'm happy. I needed to know that that was possible. And I didn't feel like I was having those stories reflected back at me. So I just thought, okay, well, if one day I feel capable, able to talk about this without bursting into tears every 2 minutes, then I will. And that's where I'm at now.
Oh, that's wonderful. So you did your TED Talk last year, and you're now a TEDx speaker coach. If you're allowed to, if it's not a secret society, can you take us behind the scenes at a TEDx event? How do you help people prepare to hone and polish their stories and then tell them in 17 minutes or less?
Oh, it's really amazing. This sounds a bit cliche, but it's just such a privilege, because I know what it means to be given the opportunity to tell your story on a stage like that. So being accepted as somebody who helps that person tell such, in such an important moment in their life, really is incredible. And I guess everyone needs a different type and level of support. Some people are really confident. Some people need help with the narrative. Other people need help with the delivery. And I think most people are just really grateful to have someone else to call and be like, oh my God, I'm worried I'm never going to learn it. I'm worried this bit sounds rubbish. Or just, I'm really nervous. Can I run through it with you? And the approach that I took was really that it's not my story to tell, it's their story. And it's something which the speakers need to really feel proud of. So yeah, I guess it's just a light touch and helping people feel that they are able to tell the story they want to tell in the most compelling way.
And do you have a series of calls with them, or is it more that you're on call when they're having a panic moment?
Oh, that's up to the individual. So they all get offered somebody to support them, and they can take it or leave it. There's no pressure. You don't have to have somebody supporting you or a coach. And I only worked with two people in TEDx this year. And I think there are some people who spoke who didn't want a coach, and some people who lent on coaches heavily, and everything in the middle. So it's something that's available to you if you feel you need it, but there's no pressure to have to do it.
Okay, great. So, Emily, you spent 20 years in business, marketing, and communications. You have now set up the Impact Apothecary with your business partner, Edward Ferris, which you call the anti-consultancy, which I just love. What was the inspiration for you behind this, and how's it going?
Well, the inspiration behind it was really the fact that I'd worked mainly in-house for most of my career, and then I left around the time that I realized I wasn't going to become a mother, and we can talk about how those two things are linked. But I worked by myself for about 3 years as a consultant, freelance, and it was rewarding and I had some great clients. But increasingly, I was doing pro bono work on the side and opening up like applications for people to be able to support them for free. And those were really the best jobs, really. They were interesting businesses and organizations who were really trying to shift something, make positive change in the world. And they were really great people to work with who were properly committed and engaged, and usually the decision makers. So when we did work together, when we did the strategic thinking or came up with storyboarding or messaging, I mean, 3 weeks later, it'd be up on a website and they would be like presenting it to to new starters and using it to recruit investors or whatever it was that they needed. And I was like, oh my God, this is amazing. Because when you work in more corporate environments, you're lucky if 20% of the work that you do really lands. And that is just a frustrating place to be, because it's not as if as a consultant, you're sitting there thinking, oh, I don't care what the results are, I just want to get paid. You put your heart and soul into it and it becomes your life for a period of time and you care deeply. And it's just frustrating if change doesn't happen. So I just started to think, oh, how can I do more of this but still meet my need to get paid? And the more people I spoke to, the more I realized that the general narrative around that was, yeah, it sucks, doesn't it, to be freelance. You've got to work for the people you don't like in order to fund the free work for the people you really like. And I just thought, oh, come on, we can't just roll over and accept that. There's got to be a different way. And I don't know what that way is, but there must be a different model that allows people like me to get paid, not, you know, millionaire level rates, but get paid a decent amount to help people who are trying to do positive things in the world. And conversely, the people who are trying to change things often don't have a huge amount of cash up front, but they need that support. And if they're relying on more junior expertise, I mean, nothing really wrong with that, but or having to apply for grants or wait for pro bono slots to open up, the world isn't going to change quickly enough with these two problems. So the Impact Apothecary is basically a big experiment that Ed and I are going through to see if there are other ways of working with these types of businesses. So founders, enlightened leaders of, generally speaking, smaller businesses who just aren't suited to the conventional consultancy model, whether that's through budget or inclination or, you know, a lot of consultancies are just very complicated and a lot of money and time is wasted. And for smaller, more agile businesses, that's just not necessary. So that's why we've set it up, to try and see if there's another way to break the consultancy system.
So you're in the middle of a grand experiment.
We're in the middle of a grand experiment. I'm glad I'm doing it with someone else, because I think it would have been difficult to do this big experiment by myself. So having somebody like a partner in crime to go out there and be like, okay, let's just try it. Let's just say yes to that person. Or let's say no to that person. Or let's try doing it differently. What would happen if we did it, you know, if the relationship worked like this instead? And some things will fail, some things will succeed. And I hope that at some point towards the end of it, I can stand up and say to people, look, you don't actually have to do it this way. There is an alternative. Watch this space.
I'm so excited to see where the two of you land. I really am. So, Emily, you've got a very close relationship to nature. That's very clear. The gardening, the fermenting, the wild swimming, the foraging, and you're a regenerative business advocate, and you focus on long-term impact and year-on-year. Short-termism is clearly hurting us and hurting the planet. What would you like business to do more of or less of to change this?
I would really like businesses to be thinking about what they measure in what they see as success. And I understand that commercials are an important part of that. I would like businesses to ask themselves, what are we making money for? Because I think that's just such an important question. Are we just making money for the sake of making money? And I think the answer to that is probably yes in a lot of instances. And in which case, is that what you want to do? Fine. I think for a lot of companies, the answer is yes. Okay, cool. There's lots of people who help you do that. But I actually believe that most businesses were founded with something else in mind. So most founders believe in some form of change, whether it is making something available to a different group of people, or whether it is bringing something to a place where it wasn't before, a democratizing access to a product or service, or having more direct relationships between producers and consumers, or helping the environment. There are so many businesses out there which might not describe themselves as purpose-led or impact-led or focused, but actually, if you follow the roots to where they began, there's usually something more than money. And then money becomes a factor, because you've got to make a living and you've got to make money to keep your business afloat. And if you don't make money, then you can't have impact. I get that. So money is always going to be something that is important to business, but it would be really great if leaders sat down and thought, why are we chasing the money in the first place? Why does the money matter? And who benefits from success? So traditionally, that's all, it's going to go into the hands of your shareholders. Fine. I'm not knocking the shareholder model. In fact, I think it can be very powerful in many ways. But I guess it's just stop and question why you're in business in the first place and why making money matters. It does matter, but why? Answer that question and figure out who you want to benefit from your success.
Yeah. And you're immersing yourself in the regenerative business world in the UK, going to conferences and meeting others. What are you learning? What's kind of bubbling up for you?
That this is not some weird left field thing anymore. This is actually a really big movement, and it's a movement. Regenerative practices of all flavors are being adopted by companies who are successful. So I find that very, very heartening. I mean, I would say 2 years ago, these thoughts were all bubbling up inside me, but I felt like I couldn't really express them because I would be shot down by the conventional business community. And then I just threw myself into that community, or not that the regenerative business community, and became curious. And I did mentoring and went into some programs and signed up to various memberships and events. And suddenly it all starts to snowball. And I appreciate that to a certain extent it's an echo chamber, but it's actually really incredible how many businesses are doing things differently and thriving. So that has given me the evidence to cement my instinct, which was, oh, A, there's a better way. And B, in the future, I know we're going through a bit of an awkward time, but in the future, I really do think that these things are going to become normalized. And if you aren't thinking about these things, it's going to be harder for you to be competitive as a business.
Yeah, I love that classic British understatement. We're going through an awkward time.
I didn't want to get into like
But I loved it. It was beautiful.
nitty-gritty. It's a bit of a blip.
And let's shift to you a little bit. What's the reason for your relationship with nature? What's behind all of that?
I think I've always actually loved nature. I was lucky enough to grow up in a house where we had, big garden and fields nearby in a time when my mum would ring the bell and we would just come from wherever we were for dinner. It was a different time, and I was very fortunate. We would go to the pond up the road and count frogs and that sort of thing. So I suppose I've always been interested in nature. And then I look back actually at the times that I was working in-house and leading teams in strip offices, and I think I still felt the calling, but it was just shut away. And really, a big part of my reconnection with nature was probably linked to the fact that I didn't have children, because it was really lonely for a time when all of my friends were off in the dark rooms of early motherhood. I just didn't see most of my friends for quite a long time. And I've always been quite a social person, and that was pretty lonely for me. So I just had to go out and find ways to be creative and fulfill my time and fulfill my curiosity, I suppose. And I did start foraging during that time, and it was actually something I did as a child. So both my parents had a light interest in foraging. My mother is from Switzerland. I think it was just part of her upbringing. My father knew quite a bit about mushrooms, so it was just something we did as a family. It was very normal for my mum to make food out of things that she picked. And so I just started reconnecting with that, really, because I had all this time on my hands. So I would just go out foraging and making things and then start to fermenting. And then, a few years later, lockdown, where kind of there were very few things you could do. That was a good one. And I suppose it just reawakened what was probably always there and I'd lost a connection to. And yeah, it's just sort of spiraled from there. And I live in a beautiful part of the world. Like, you just want to get out because there's incredible, incredible countryside around here, and the ch clear chalk stream rivers and the New Forest and the sea. Like, it would be a crime to not experience nature if you live somewhere beautiful.
Yes, I completely agree. So I walk every morning in the forests of Heidelberg, and I actually think my habit of walking in the forest changed me completely. I think it was part of my shift out of corporate into what I do now. I really think it was.
It is, and once you start listening to it, you can't stop it. I started, so I worked on an industrial estate for a long, long time, But I discovered this little, I mean, I don't know why it took me so long. It just shows how switched off I was. I discovered after many years that there was this tiny little woodland walk around the back of some building three blocks down. I was like, oh my God. Okay, it's only, so it only takes me 5 minutes to walk it. But from that point on, as long as it wasn't pouring with rain, every meeting I had with my team was a walking meeting. And before you knew it, we discovered an extension to the walk. And suddenly the whole team was just walking and having walking meetings. And it was like, okay, we can't have meetings in an office anymore. It's rubbish.
Love that, Emily. So I'm glad you brought up your team, because I wanted to ask you, you know, how do you think about or describe your leadership style?
I think it's very enthusiastic, quite a positive style. I believe that most people have got the answers, and your job as a leader is to help them be the best that they can be and realize their potential. And yes, sometimes you get the wrong person in the wrong role, the wrong environment, and that is difficult. Another awkward situation. But on the whole, I think most people respond best to positivity and encouragement and empowerment. It's obviously not always that easy. It sounds like some utopia, but that is what I try to do. And I don't know. I think if you can inspire people, then you tend to get the best out of them.
Yeah.
It's not always easy, because the pressures of, particularly when you work within a corporate environment, you aren't always given the tools to be the kind of leader that you want to be. And that's definitely been true for me at certain points in my corporate career.
Yeah, it feels like a friction sometimes.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
Emily, do you think about your own reputation? And if so, how do you think about it?
Yeah, I've struggled thinking about this, because I do think that a reputation is really quite important. And I mean, even if you don't want it to be, it's a fact that it exists. So pretending that your reputation is not an important part of your persona is probably, I don't know, it's potentially a bit foolish to think, just to wish it didn't exist. So it does exist. And I suppose I care too much what people think about me, definitely. And when I examine where that's come from, I do think it is linked to the expectations that were put on me as a girl, a little girl and a young woman, and then going into the workplace. I don't know if this is true for every woman, and I don't think you can make such generalizations, but I definitely know that I had to be better behaved, smarter, more efficient, more productive, a stronger people leader than a lot of my male peers. I just came under more criticism, and I was held to higher standards than others. And certainly as a younger woman in business, I just had to basically be perfect. And that, I guess in many ways, was a good thing, because I had to, like, you know, I learned a lot and I got to a point where I was quite good at a lot of things because I basically had to be. But I've now that I'm in my 40s, I'm spending time unpicking some of the damage that I did, because the people pleasing is ingrained in me. And so linked to the reputation question, I'm careful about understanding that my reputation exists. And, you know, you want to make sure that that is a thing that you consider, but at the same time, understanding that you can't please everyone. And the most important thing is that you're your authentic self. And some people might not like that, but the people who do like it will be the ones that matter most. But it's easy to say that. And it's hurtful when you realize that there are people who don't like what you're saying, or who don't resonate with you, or who don't like your energy. But you can't change your energy to serve those people, because it will just tear you apart.
Yeah, and I love what you said about having to unpick the lessons, because that's something I've thought about a lot, is that culture puts so much weight on girls, and we sort of labor under that weight, thinking I'm doing the right thing, I'm doing the right thing, and then at some point it becomes unbearable, whether through a life experience, often with women it's perimenopause, where they start going, I'm not doing that anymore, and throwing it over their shoulder. I definitely had an experience of unpicking what the culture had told me was the right way to be, and it's amazingly liberating.
Okay, I'll let you know when I get there.
When you throw it off.
Yeah, I mean, really I can feel how liberating it is starting to feel, but I'm still in the process of looking back and thinking, oh, actually, yeah. That comment in that performance review when I was 25, you know, all these things which I took to heart. I was like, oh my gosh, this person said this thing about me. It must be true. And I need to be this to be this. And then realizing actually, there was some gray area there.
Yeah, that's the culture speaking.
Yeah.
It's interesting, isn't it? So that speaks to the leadership archetype, that we have this thing in our brain of leadership must be loud, it must be confident, it must be room owning. And it's kind of stuck in our brains. It's lodged inside us. And as you know, with We Need New Leaders, my kind of passion and mission is to try and shift that, to make it easier for both young women and men when they come into the workplace to not feel they have the sort of concrete weight of expectation on their shoulders, that they can lead and be whoever they are and experience liberation before they hit perimenopause or a work crisis. So what do you think we can do collectively and individually to change that archetype that has landed upon us?
Well, I think that one really important thing we can do is we need to stop criticizing people who do things differently. And there are lots of other, perhaps more obvious things that I could say about what we need to do. But from a collective mindset, let's take an organization. If you have a new leader and they are doing things a bit differently, we can not rush to judgment, and we can just let people, give people the chance to do things in their own way. I've witnessed particularly female leaders. I mean, that might just be the experience I had, but when female leaders came in and they didn't do things in the same way as the alpha CEO who just left or whatever, people were very quick to say, oh, well, she hasn't got what it takes. Oh my gosh, did you see that press interview? Or, oh my goodness. Or she's a bit of a bulldog, you know, just because she might be assertive. And I just think actually, you know, I'm talking about women, but I'm talking about any different, anything that deviates from that sort of alpha leader role. I think we can give people a chance and support them a bit more, because if we start taking them down immediately, then there's just, we're not serving ourselves, because no one really likes the alpha leaders either. So why don't we just sort of give everyone a chance and also allow people to make mistakes, because we live in a world where people just can't make mistakes, and that is not cool. I mean, if I've been judged on every mistake I've made, I wouldn't have made it in my career past 19. Maybe not even, you know, actually, especially not even. Those early years are riddled with errors, but people are human, and I think we want human leaders. So we have to accept that they're going to sometimes behave in an imperfect way, and we don't have to tear them down.
Yeah, so don't criticize. And I'm having some incoherent thoughts in my head about,
yeah,
is there some sort of matching or some sort of parallel of this description of don't tear people down, don't criticize, allow people to be who they are. Is there a parallel to what you're seeing in regenerative business practices? Is there something that we can sort of draw together? And as I said, it's incoherent, but it just feels like it's an opening space on some level.
I think so. I would just say, I don't mean don't criticize. I think that part of being, having a healthy culture and being an effective leader is being open to feedback. Something that with my people pleasing, I've obviously struggled with sometimes, but now I see well-meaning feedback from somebody you respect as a gift. Sounds cheesy, but it actually is. But those two things, well-meaning and from someone you respect, they're crucial. But when it comes to regenerative principles, well, I mean, I think you might ask me to recommend a book, so I'm just going to go and put it out there now. There's a woman called Carol Sanford who's written lots of incredible books, and one of them is called Indirect Work. I have to admit, it's quite a hard read. I actually listened to it as an audiobook, and it's hard because she actively demands that you pause the book and reflect and don't eat it up quickly, and that you consider the way you are taking on the information that she's presenting and question the connections and assumptions that you're making. So when I first started this book, I just thought, I can't be doing this. I just need you to tell me what I need to know and move on. But it was an extremely, I still think about the way that she writes that book now. But the point is, the point of that book really is the power of not being a directly forcing things, and the power of being indirect in the way that you lead. and really that's a hard thing to describe, but forcing people to behave in a certain way and telling them how to behave is not actually very effective. Creating the conditions that they need to thrive and empowering them to live up to their potential is the goal. And that is a much more regenerative way of leading a team or a business or whatever organization you want to be calling it. So I would say, I don't know if that really links into what we were talking about, but thinking about regenerative leadership and regenerative business, I do think those principles are really important.
Yeah, and as you talk about creating the conditions for people to thrive, it does make me think of garden and soil and plants and blooming. So there's, you know, there is definitely a lovely metaphor in there. So to the standard questions or the questions I always ask, you've given us a beautiful book recommendation, Indirect Work, which I'm going to go and take a look at because it sounds absolutely
it's
fascinating.
It's a hard read, but it's really worth spending some time with because it does change the way you perceive things.
Yeah, I'd like that. And there's summer coming up and I'm going to be stepping off the book marketing carousel quite soon. And so be time to read a hard book. I'm looking forward to that. As you well know, We Need New Leaders is written towards diverse leaders from different kinds of backgrounds, people of diverse identities, people from underrepresented minorities. If these folks are entering the workplace now and have a sense that they'd like to become a leader, to either land, keep, or create their dream leadership role, what tips would you give them?
I would say that it's really important to embark on a lifelong journey of self-discovery. I don't think you can be an effective leader if you don't understand yourself and you don't understand that you don't understand all of yourself, if you know what I mean. So I think a journey of self-discovery, which will go on for as long as you live, is really important to be an effective leader. And linked to that is to then just be yourself and be authentically you. That does not mean don't take on board feedback, because I think sometimes people get those two things confused. But just develop that sense of intuition and know when you're speaking and acting from a place of authenticity. And if you can always say, well, yeah, maybe I made a mistake there, but I was acting from a place of genuinely thinking about other people and genuinely being in my own power, not trying to hurt people, trying to be constructive, then you're going to make mistakes, but at least you can say, okay, look, I did my best. And I suppose linked to that again is do be selective about the feedback that you choose to take on board. And you can only really start to do that if you do the personal work and you understand what authenticity means for you. And you will find people along the way who you do not respect but are in positions of power over you, who give you feedback that you don't agree with, and you're in a sticky situation because you're like, okay, well, I'm not going to get my bonus unless I change my behavior, but I don't want to be like you because I don't respect you. So what do I do? I haven't really got any answers for you there. Navigate that on a situation by situation basis. But if you're open to feedback, then you will occasionally find people along the way who you really respect. And when they offer you some suggestions or some feedback, that's when you really want to listen, because those are the people that you can trust that their feedback is coming from a place of kindness and support, not control and fear or nastiness.
Oh, those are beautiful. I'm just going to repeat them back. So it's a lifelong journey of self-discovery. Be yourself, be authentically yourself, and understand and know your values so that you can do so. And then be selective about the feedback that you listen to. Because back to what we were saying, if the culture is pressurizing you to be in a certain way because you don't show up in a way that feels normal to the culture, then it's going to try and shape you and force you into a box. So be selective according to your values about the feedback that you take on. Yeah. And Emily, we're living, to quote you, in awkward times. What brings you joy?
What brings me joy? Well, I mean, we've covered a lot of it, haven't we? Your introduction. I do love being in nature, and that doesn't mean that I necessarily go out like hiking in the pouring rain. But I just take a lot of joy from being outside. I take a lot of joy from being with my family and my friends. I mean, the usual things, I think. But what I've done, what I've been able to do, is create a lifestyle that means that I can connect with those things. And that has that's been hard work, and it's also been through an element of luck that I have been somebody who's able to follow my instincts and understand and go on a journey to understand what it is that I'm about. And I suppose that's really where I end on my TEDx talk, is for everything I went through, I actually see it as a gift, because it forced me to have to go on a journey to discover who I was and make decisions. And once you start to uncover who you are, it's really hard to ignore that. And yeah, so what brings me joy? Having the independence and freedom that I have to pursue the things that pique my interest, to spend time with my family and be outside, and just to feed my curiosity.
Oh, Emily Monsell Holden, what a lovely answer. Thank you for joining me on Speech Bubbles.
You've been listening to another production from Solid Gold Podcasts.